Thank you. May it please the court. My name is William Weiner. I represent Petitioner Kesser. My co-counsel is Russell Covey. He represents Petitioner Leahy. We're going to divide our time 15 minutes each. I'm going to try to keep track, and counsel will interrupt me if I go over. I'm going to attempt to do my best, at least our attempt, is to answer the questions and argue straight Batson issues. I have 3 points to make regarding it, and my co-counsel is going to attempt to respond and answer questions and argue concerning the mixed motive analysis. A petitioner contends that the state's Batson's analysis was wrong for 3 separate reasons. Number one, at step 2, the framework requires a race-neutral reason, and that wasn't given. Number 2, if you do reach step 3, the state concluded that a motivating factor at step 3 was race-based, and that itself requires reversal. And number 3, if this court concludes that the state's conclusion at step 3 was, as a matter of law, appropriate, that no deference is due that conclusion because it was based on an unreasonable determination of the facts before the court. I start out with number 1, the race-neutral argument that I'm about to make.
I have a question with respect to the role of the findings of fact by the state court and how it would affect all 3 steps or all 3 parts of your analysis if you could work it in somewhere else.
Okay, and actually I'll just go right to step 3 then. I think that may answer your question. Of course, I'm quite aware of the fact that deference is due to factual findings made by state court. I think the court understands that the DCA in this case at step 3 made a factual finding. The DCA, if it is a factual finding, concluded the following, that the trial court could have reasonably based the neutral explanations given by the prosecutor as the predominating reasons. So,
it made a difference, Mike, because it said, were this the only or primary reason given by the prosecutor that might be cause for concern?
That's true.
I think that reasonably read is a finding that it wasn't either the only or the primary reason.
That's right. It wasn't the only, and it wasn't the primary, and it wasn't the predominant, which is the point I was making, and I think you're absolutely right, Your Honor. It said the trial court could have found that the predominating factors were neutral, and I think that's correct. Okay, even if it did make its own finding, let's just look at it. First of all, it made its own finding, giving deference to the trial court under California law, and we know the trial court, of course, didn't recognize the race-based reasons given by the prosecutor. It also said that under California law, the prosecutor's reasons are deemed to be constitutional, are presumed to be constitutional. That was part of the finding that it made. But perhaps more importantly,
perhaps you're not focusing on the part of it that I'm focusing on. The Court of Appeals said, were this the one, that is, the race-based aspect, were this the only or primary reason you would have some cause for concern?
Yes.
What went on?
That's right. And let me just get right to the cut then and get to your question. And that is, by stating that, obviously what the court is saying, it wasn't the only reason. It was a reason. Race-based factor clearly was a reason, but it was not the primary reason, I think, in your words, or in my words, the predominant reason. Well, I think Hernandez answers that question. In Hernandez, which was a step 2 case, Hernandez indicated that if solely race is at least part of the reason, there's a constitutional violation. And that's why I said it was an admission by the DCA, whether it's a legal conclusion, which I believe it is, or whether it's a finding of fact, the DCA clearly said, as I agree with the court, that it was a reason for the strike. I mean, let's face it. The trial court says to the prosecutor, what are your reasons for striking these people? And the prosecutor said, my reasons are their distrust of the criminal justice system. And then he goes on later and gives the child molestation speech. He didn't come out of the blue with that. He's literally responding to the trial court's request. Give me your reasons for striking these people. And so I agree with Your Honor. Now, I disagree that it wasn't the primary reason, but that's besides the point. The Court of Appeals, and I agree with you, did clearly find that that was a reason. And if it was a reason, that's it. Well, let me just keep on the reason, because I think it's important that Your Honor recognize that. Arlington Heights is what Hernandez is based upon, is what Batson is based upon. Arlington Heights, Mount Healthy, and also the Feeney case. All these are equal protection cases. And in each one of those equal protection cases, the court made it quite clear that if race is a part of the reason, just one single part of the reason and nothing more, an equal protection violation has occurred. And that's what has happened here based on the finding. If there's an affirmative defense, as I would have done it anyway, that wasn't done in this case. And, of course, I'll leave that to my counsel. If the court would prefer, I'll respond to it. But my counsel would be able to argue that.
I'm not understanding the difference between your argument and your counsel's argument. Is your argument that there should be no affirmative defense in a Batson case, and that's simply by if one of the reasons or a substantial reason or a motivating reason, however we couched it, is found that is the Batson defense fails at stage two, or the justification fails at stage two, and that's it?
That's correct, Your Honor. That is one of my contentions, that it fails at step two. And the reason
that's it. There's no defense.
There's no defense at that point. We have a direct. The reason that you have a step three is because there's a pretext. The normal procedure would be the prosecutor comes up and comes up with neutral reasons. So then there's a pretext argument that's made basically at step three. There's no need to do that. The question to the prosecutor is, what are your reasons? And he gives his reasons. We now know that a reason, and all you need is a reason, a motivating factor, and here it's clearly an enormous overarching philosophy concerning Native Americans and the distrust they have of the criminal justice system as a reason. There's no need to go any further. He has said, my reason, at least in part, for striking that juror is because she's Native American and she distrusts the criminal justice system.
Then you do need, though, to explain, and I think there may be explanations, but you need to explain why we wouldn't. You seemed earlier to be relying on Arlington Heights and Mount Healthy and so on, but they do have an affirmative defense available, and you seem to be saying that none is available here. So the question is why.
I will respond to that as well. In my view, Arlington Heights is talking about a civil case. It's talking about a case where there's liability. It's talking about a case where there's interrogatories, where there's depositions, where there's trial testimony. It's talking about a situation where the finder of fact, whether it's a judge or a jury, has an enormous panoply of information before it, and the plaintiff and the defendant can develop that case. We know from the Batson inquiry that it's a prompt hearing. The jury is waiting. Witnesses are usually waiting. We want to do things as fast as possible. And we also know the dictates of Batson. It's most compelling in the jury selection process. We're not talking about a civil liability. What the court says about Batson is race neutrality, the 14th Amendment, is the most compelling place for that is in the jury selection process. And it talks about there's absolutely no place for race whatsoever as a criteria. And if it is a criteria, even one thing is given. The minimal standard that we can expect from a prosecutor, it's so easy to get over the second hump, is to require race neutrality. That's what Batson says. To say otherwise is to make an exception to the force and logic of the Batson principle. And so I believe it shouldn't apply.
We don't have a Supreme Court case applying Batson in a mixed motive context.
We don't have the Supreme Court applying Batson in a mixed motive analysis. I agree with Your Honor. We don't. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm trying to think it through. Yes, it is true.
Now, given the deferential standard of review that we are required to apply in AEDPA, under AEDPA, why isn't it incumbent upon us, even required, for us to accept the state court's analysis, even though, as you, I think, explicitly argue, it flies in the teeth of Arlington Heights and many other federal case, mixed motive cases. But we don't have a Supreme Court case applying Batson, and as you pointed out, it is different. The context is different from civil cases. Why don't we just say, well, the state courts didn't do what we would have done, didn't do what other circuits would have done, didn't do what the Supreme Court did in other contexts.
But there is no Supreme Court case directly on point, and therefore we defer.
I think I understand Your Honor's question. I can answer it in two ways. The first answer that I have for Your Honor is that the force and logic of the Supreme Court cases, all of them, clearly indicate that the purpose of the 14th Amendment was race neutrality and to eradicate.
The answer is, in terms of the statute, you said that's an unreasonable application of Supreme Court precedent.
That's correct, Your Honor. So that's the first reason one might...
It's unreasonable for state court to adopt a different analysis than the Supreme Court has applied in every other... That's a good answer. What's your other answer? You said you have a second answer. I mean, unless it's a good enough answer. It's a good answer. I don't understand.
The second reason is that actually the lower court not only didn't follow Batson, it didn't follow the mixed motive analysis itself. It just didn't apply it. Nobody applied it. The mixed motive analysis, as I'm sure Your Honors are aware of, requires basically at step two the switching of the burden of persuasion. Now not only does the prosecutor have to come up with race-neutral reasons, which here he clearly didn't, as Judge Callan pointed out, but once he doesn't come up with a race-neutral reason, then the prosecutor has to come forward and say, well, I might have said that, but actually that's not really a reason. All these other reasons are the real reasons that I would have done it anyway. That wasn't done here. The trial court, of course, didn't even hear it, didn't understand it, didn't recognize it, and the DCA itself never mentioned the full thing, never talked about the child molestation speech that was given, and never put the burden on the prosecutor, as the judge forcefully pointed out.
Let me get you back to the earlier question that you answered. The way I understand 2254D, the state's decision for us to police it and do something about it with habeas has to be clearly contrary to a holding of the Supreme Court. And I wonder why it doesn't follow from your unavoidable concession that the Supreme Court has not decided a mixed motive Batson case, that we just do not have authority to issue to direct issuance of a writ.
I'll answer that question. First of all, the Supreme Court has decided it. It has said it requires race neutrality. So in my view, the Supreme Court has decided this issue. Race neutrality is required at step two. If it's not given, that's the end of the issue. That's my answer to that. But I'll go on. The second reason is that if the Supreme Court came out with a ruling and a principle and an enunciation, and the state court made an exception to that, the state court would always say, EPA says... You have to defer to this. This is an exception. The Supreme Court didn't rule on this exception. It didn't rule on this exception. It didn't rule on this exception. The whole idea, of course, is the force and logic of the Supreme Court's enunciations. The Supreme Court never departed from these. In all of its cases, even most recently in Miller L., it said the same thing as strongly as possible. Just one factor is sufficient. One factor is sufficient. And we require race neutrality. It's never come off of that. If you would allow that right now, you'd let the state, in every case when there's a broad principle like this being stated repeatedly, not just once, in every single case by the majority of the Supreme Court, and the state could simply say, well, they never decided this point. They never decided this point. That's true. It's never come before the court. But it has been decided. A fortiori, what the Supreme Court said.
The 8th Circuit's got it wrong.
Could you... state that?
Yeah, the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 8th, and 11th circuits have got it wrong.
I understand what Your Honor is saying, and of course my counsel will handle that. In my own humble view, yes, I think they do have it wrong. But even if they have it right, it was misapplied here. It wasn't applied here. There was no shifting of any burden. The trial court didn't shift the burden. The DCA didn't shift the burden. And the finding, as I point out to particularly Your Honor, is just what you said, a finding that race was a factor. Not that race didn't play a role. But a finding that race was a factor.
It wasn't the primary factor, which is exactly what you'd find if you had shifted the burdens. The same thing.
I think the court is quite clear, the DCA is quite clear that it was a factor, and the Supreme Court has made it quite clear if it is a factor, that's the end of it. Even if you apply the mixed motive analysis, if that is a factor which caused the prosecutor to excuse this juror, then an equal protection violation has occurred.
But also, it isn't at all clear to me that the... Court of Appeals made a finding It said, well, this is the only reason given by the prosecutor. And then he said he gave the prosecutor give more reasons. But he never made a judgment about those reasons. He never ultimately, what one is doing at stage three is making a pretext analysis. Was that ever done here?
No,
ab initio by the State Court of Appeals?
No, you're absolutely right. It never recognized that all Native Americans were excluded, that all minorities were excluded. It didn't perform a comparative juror analysis, which was performed by...
But even verbally, despite how complicated it was,
no, it did not.
Did it ever make
sense? It did not, whatsoever. It just looked at what the trial court said and said, well, there was four reasons and there was this reason. There was this overarching philosophy and there were these reasons as well. There's four versus one. So the neutral reasons predominate, recognizing that a reason was still the fact that Native Americans were not fit to be jurors.
Never deciding whether the reasons given were the actual reasons. That's really what ultimately is going on in stage three.
That's correct, Your Honor. That was not done. That was not performed as well. If the court has further questions, my time, I don't want to take my counsel's time here. Thank you very much, Your Honors. I appreciate your time and patience.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm going to try to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and in the remaining 10 minutes that I have, I'd like to establish the following 3 points. First, that even if the state court may apply a mixed motive standard to evaluate a Batson challenge, it still must apply clearly established Supreme Court law. Here, the state courts never shifted the burden of proof to the prosecutor, as required by the Supreme Court's mixed motive cases, including the Arlington Heights case. In the Price Waterhouse case.
Well, tell me why it makes a difference here, given what it did say.
Your Honor, I think it makes an enormous difference. Justice O'Connor rightly described the effect of a burden shift as strong medicine. In this particular case, there was an enormous amount of evidence in the record that would indicate that race was a motivating factor in the exercise of the prosecutor's strikes. None of that evidence was considered by either of the state courts below. The prosecutor had the burden to show that the race-neutral reasons that he did articulate would in and of themselves have been sufficient to cause him to exercise the strikes. And that showing simply has not been made, nor has it been required. And under this court's Caliendo case, the failure of a state court to apply the proper burden-shifting standard is wrong as a matter of law, and its factual findings are not entitled to deference when it fails to apply the proper.
Can you point out any jury peremptory case where the burden shifting that you say is settled doctrine is commented on?
The burden shifting has been applied in numerous Supreme Court cases, Arlington Heights, Price Waterhouse, Hunter v. Underwood.
Was that a peremptory case?
That was not, Your Honor, but several.
Please pay attention to the question I asked. Is there one jury selection case in which the burden shifting, which you are laying out as the settled rule, was applied?
Yes, Your Honor. The numerous circuit court cases have so held.
Was there one Supreme Court case?
The Supreme Court case has never had an opportunity to consider the application of mixed motive to the Batson situation, but that does not mean that it is therefore permissible. Our argument, clear, Your Honors, is that...
How do you apply Price Waterhouse in your context? How do you analyze what Price Waterhouse is telling us in this context, if at all?
Price Waterhouse establishes and speaks to the causation question, I think most directly, Your Honor, and most helpfully. The Court of Appeal in this case did not find that a race-neutral reason was not the but-for cause of the strikes. To the extent that it made any factual findings, it found that it was not the predominant or primary reason. But that finding in and of itself does not address the relevant question. The question is, would the prosecutor have struck the jurors wholly for race-neutral reasons? That a predominant reason can be race-neutral, but yet the but-for cause of a strike can be race-based, I think, is clear. It's like the proverbial camel, Your Honor. You could load up the back of a camel with 500 pounds of race-neutral reasons, but if the race-biased straw breaks the camel's back, the race-biased straw is the legal cause or a legal cause of the camel's injury.
Do you see...
What role does the finding of fact in the California court play, which was, of course, affirmed within the California appellate system, with respect to this precise point?
Okay. The California court made no findings applying the proper burden-shifting standard as the mixed motive analysis requires. The findings of fact that the California court did make were merely that, at best, that the race-based reason was not primary, but that does not preclude a finding that the race reason was the but-for or the tipping reason that caused the strike. Yes, Your Honor.
The trial court, I gather that you're assuming, because the state court of appeals essentially assumed, that the state trial court's findings are not due deference because he erred at stage one of Batson, and that's sort of off the table.
Yes, Your Honor. And
isn't our analysis different, though, under habeas and AEDPA than it would be under a direct appeal? I'm hearing you argue how we would approach it under a direct appeal, but we still have that, pesky AEDPA to deal with.
Yes, we do, Your Honor. I would point to the Caliendo case as a template for how the AEDPA analysis applies in a case where the state courts fail to apply the proper burden-shifting standard, which is what it was required to do if we were to turn to mixed motive analysis, as the state urges. When the courts fail to analyze the case under the proper standard, its factual determinations are not entitled to deference, and this court should make a de novo review of the evidence and the record. And I think the evidence in this case is overwhelming that the state has not carried and cannot carry his burden to show that race didn't matter at all.
Counsel, the presupposition there is that race has to not matter at all, even if it is a subordinate rather than a primary or predominant factor.
Yes, Your Honor.
It appears to me you don't have a Supreme Court case that says that in the context of jury selection.
I think that there are some cases like the Alexander v. Louisiana case, which was a question that went to the composition of the veneer and not the petty jury.
You've got emanations and numbers, but you don't have the case yet.
Yes, Your Honor, but maybe if I can clarify, our argument is that the trial court, when confronted with a mixed motive...
Let me get to the trial court now.
Okay.
You've argued about whether the prosecutor was put to his burden. I look at the transcript at page 3377, ER 84, and it looks like the judge says, well, let's talk about the four that you corrected that are... that the defense challenges, and he puts the prosecutor to his burden. And then the prosecutor just reads his notes. Some of it's irrelevant. The person lived in Humboldt County for 25 years. He just reads his notes and gives all of the things in his notes. Some of the things in his notes are race, and you can't really tell whether it's an identifying factor or a reason for the challenge. And then at the end, the judge gives his findings. And as I read the appellate court decision, there's some things it doesn't talk about because there's really no context. The record is clear. And the judge says, as to Ringles, which is the toughest one, there's sufficient justification because in his understanding of what the prosecutor did, it was that she worked for the tribe, not because she was one of the tribe. Just like in a plaintiff's personal injury case, the plaintiff's lawyer preempts people who work for insurance, the insurance industry.
Yes, Your Honor. And that understanding, that factual finding was found to be erroneous both by the Court of Appeal and by the District Court, which confirmed that the judge simply misunderstood what the lawyer was saying. Moreover, to the extent that the trial court was asking the prosecutor to carry a burden, it was merely his burden of production at step two of the Batson inquiry to come forward with a race-neutral explanation for his strikes. The Court of Appeals Court of Appeals stated that had the
were this the only or primary reason
yes.
we would have cause for concern?
Yes, yes,
well,
Your
that's
Honor.
That's not a determination that the finding of fact is erroneous.
That's
you rely on?
Yes,
the proposition that they made a finding that it was erroneous? Determination that it was erroneous?
Yes, Your Honor. And to the extent that that's not a finding of fact, I think I think that the Court of Appeal would be rebutted by clear and convincing evidence, and the District Court concluded that the trial court had not found one of the reasons to be race-based was rebutted by the transcript of the proceeding. The step two burden is merely one of production to come forward with a race-neutral explanation. That's all the prosecutor was asked to do in this case. I think it should be it's important to clarify that co-counsel's argument is that Batson says that in order to get to step three, the prosecutor has to come forward with a race-neutral explanation. That was not done in this case, and so we're alleging that under well-established Batson principles, it was wrong to go to step three.
Self-importance, emotionality about the system, dysfunctional family, unstable. You have a lot of race-neutral.
There were a whole lot of race-neutral reasons, but there was also an admission of a racially discriminatory purpose. There was no showing of causation as is required under the mixed motive rubric, if it applies here. Your Honors, if I could reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'd like to start off by talking about the comparative juror analysis issue, if the Court would prefer that I start with that. Our position has always been that in California, as well as in Burks v. Borg, the Ninth Circuit agrees with the California Supreme Court that on review for the first time on a cold record, you cannot conduct an adequate comparative juror analysis. You don't have a record. You don't have any statement of reasons from the prosecutor as to his strategies in allowing certain jurors to sit and other jurors to be excused. Neither of the three defense attorneys here raised that issue at trial. In contrast to Miller L., where you had a Batson remand hearing 2 years after the trial, as well as a Swain hearing during the trial, where the prosecutor was cross-examined and put on evidence, and he himself brought up the question of the reasons he allowed several other, I believe he identified two.
This was addressed in a 28J letter that you sent in recently. Suppose we were to conclude, however, that what was done was not proper, that is, that there was no Batson mixed motive conclusion or analysis done. And as you point out, there was a recent case, I think, in the Second Circuit, which looked at different ways to deal with that. But if we were to do that, if we were to, for example, have a remand to the state court to have a hearing, at that point, could a comparative analysis be done?
I believe it could. I'm not aware of a case that combined the two in a remand situation like that. I looked around for a few. I didn't find anything where both of those issues were resolved on a remand like that, but I don't see any reason why it couldn't be done, because obviously in this situation, the prosecution has, the defense has to put on some evidence. Otherwise, you cannot reverse under the federal rules of appellate procedure. You can't reverse a judgment where there has been a procedural default like that. this issue wasn't raised at trial. If there is going to be a remand for a mixed motive question to be resolved with testimony, with findings by the state court judge, and then deference to those findings by the district court, as was done in, or as was recommended in the cases that I cited to the court, I don't see any reason why the question of comparative juror analysis couldn't be resolved.
I don't see how you could. If the defense had said during voir dire, how come you challenged the Indian to work for the tribe, but you didn't challenge some white person to work for the tribe, then I could see where the prosecutor could answer. But my gosh, the defense lawyer, or rather the prosecutor here, says it's kind of mysterious. I give him these letter grades, and here are my notes, and that's why I bump on him. When I did criminal defense, if you had asked me 3 weeks after a trial why I corrected this juror, not that one, I would have no idea. I couldn't remember. I wouldn't remember who they were, anything about them, really. I don't understand what we would do on a remand.
I suppose it would depend on what kind of notes still existed in the record. If the prosecutor had maintained his notes of his reasons, I know many. I've had some trial experience myself, and I know that I maintain records of every a description, little capsule description of each juror, making little notes to myself. And it's my understanding that the state has still maintained all of those records as to the progress of this trial, and in fact never really forgot this trial because it's been going on through the appellate process for quite some years now. And I think that it is possible to reconstruct, which is what they call this kind of a hearing, a reconstruction hearing under the Howard v. Senkowski terminology, to reconstruct your reasons for why you allowed a certain, I should say, to reconstruct the similarities, if there were similarities, between a juror who was allowed to remain on the panel and one who was challenged. For example, one of the reasons in this proceeding that was raised by the defense was that a white juror had some problems, with his employment. He ran a trucking company, for example. That issue could be raised on a remand hearing, I suppose, and could be dealt with.
Was it clearly established a Supreme Court precedent prior to Miller L. that a comparative analysis was even indicated, let alone required?
In Miller L., no. In Miller L., what happened...
My question was it clearly established prior to Miller L. that a comparative analysis was required?
For the first time on appeal?
At any time.
No, well, for the first time on appeal, no, it certainly wasn't, and it still isn't. Under Miller L. itself, it wasn't conducted for the first time on appeal. The comparative juror analysis technique has been done where there has been that analysis done in the trial court, and U.S. Supreme Court precedent does not dictate otherwise, does not require it. And in Miller L., the situation was you had a remand where the prosecutor did, in fact, bring up the issue. There certainly was no objection to it being done by the U.S. Supreme Court, and it wasn't really an issue in the U.S. Supreme Court. The propriety of it wasn't really an issue in Miller L. Really, what was going on in Miller L. was a discussion of the death qualification issue among the black and the white jurors and the so-called disparate questioning. It was a very discrete issue, easily dealt with, and very easily resolved. In this situation where you have multiple reasons given for a particular challenge, you're going to have a much more difficult time of parsing out what was the real reason, what was the predominant reason here.
Let's get past the comparative analysis. I mean, this was maybe a poorly phrased by opposing counsel, so I chose to deal with it. But let's get back to the Court of Appeal opinion. The Court of Appeal seemed to say, in the passage that counsel used to, and maybe just trying to learn from, that the first, the primary reason that the prosecutor would have caused some concern. And I think that's probably fair to have it saying that they think that's a bad reason. I would dispute that, but let's take that not a basic reason. So, assuming we read it that way, the court then goes on and
There must be a finding that there was a that the prosecutor would have stuck the jurors even without the impermissible reason. Does he make a finding? It seems to adopt a primary mode of analysis, and this was not the primary motive, but he doesn't even make a finding that there was a primary motive. It says only that the trial court could have found a primary motive. So it imputes to the trial court an analysis it didn't engage in, and simply tells us that it believes, had it engaged in the analysis, it could have come to a particular conclusion.
My reading of that statement by the Court of Appeal is that the court is interpreting a somewhat ambiguous or at least incomplete statement by the trial court, which is the trial court said, I find sufficient justification. Trial court made this finding after listening to all of the reasons, including the three pages or so of comments, background information.
The trial court didn't think there was any racially motivated reason at all.
It appears that the appellate court is aware that the statement that the prosecutor made was based on a racial stereotype. It is somewhat unclear, but that seems to be the interpretation given. Yes, assuming that.
We read it that way. We read that statement in the first sentence where they gingerly say we have some cause for concern. Let's assume we read that as saying it is a race, a conscious, and impermissible motive. Okay. Accept that for the purpose of the question.
Right.
Okay. So then we have a state court, the top one, that fails to recognize and is using that the prosecutor gave a race bias reason. And then we have a court of appeal that says that's wrong, there was one. We look at the whole record and we see there are other reasons there. And the state top court could have found those other reasons sufficient to be the predominant reason. But of course, the state trial court had no cause to make such a finding because it didn't realize that any of the reasons were permissible. So the Court of Appeal doesn't make the finding that there was another predominant reason. Obviously, it can't defer to a state, to a trial court decision of having made that kind of finding because the state trial court didn't engage in that analysis, as we know. So we are left without a finding in the state court, even assuming that the predominant reason analysis works. We don't have a state finding. We don't have a state court finding that there was a predominant reason that was other than the obtained one.
How do you deal with that? The way I deal with it is I look at the arguments that were put forth by the defense, the three defense attorneys, as well as the statements of the prosecutor, both in making his initial comments and responding to the arguments, and then the court makes its finding. In the trial court, yes. There were arguments where the defense attorney said, basically, this is a racist reason. This is the reason. I haven't heard anything yet that indicates that anything but a race reason is what's going on here. None of these other reasons, these are just make weight, they're pretext. This is the real reason. That's what the defense argument
right.
was.
And the district, the trial court, apparently accepting that, said that that reason was not a racial reason.
No, the trial court said, I find sufficient justification, meaning impliedly referring to all of the reasons given.
One of them is at least that she worked for the tribe, not that because she was one of the tribe, but that she worked for the tribe. That's entirely different.
One of them.
Other than the fact that she's Indian. So, in other words, he did not regard that as a racial reason. And the whole dialogue before that, which got what was about that reason and had the prosecutor going on about the fact that Native American cultures, we can't trust Native American child molesters the same way we treat them the way we treat other child molesters, and goes on at some length about... to defend his position that Native Americans do violate our laws differently and have different attitude toward the criminal system. So that was the whole dialogue. That's all the discussion was.
The trial court statement, before it said, I find sufficient justification, or within the same paragraph there, the trial court said one of those reasons. The court was listening to everything that the prosecutor said and found sufficient justification. You can't infer from the record.
I don't understand the answer to my question. Are you saying that when the Court of Appeal said the trial court could have found the other legal phenomenon, the non-terrorist legal phenomenon, if the trial court in fact made that finding.
I'm saying that the Court of Appeals said, and I'm...
Why don't you say yes or no?
No, I'm not saying that.
You're not saying that the trial court in fact made a finding that the other means for that.
No, yes, I am making that finding. That is my statement. That is our position, that the trial court made a finding that that the reasons were sufficient to justify the challenge. Well, it says it right at the...
give me a place so that I can let the trial find it. A page or a line number would be best of all.
Well, I quoted the actual statement, I find sufficient justification.
Give it to me in the transcript. So tell me where it is in the transcript. The transcript starts at page 3374, I believe.
Yes.
3581. And then it goes on for some comments.
There's no doubt.
I'm afraid that my records are a little... I wasn't ready for the... okay, here we go. At the end of the prosecutor's comments, after the defense attorneys, the three defense attorneys argued, the court says, all right, the court finds there is sufficient justification to support the peremptory challenges. This is the statement that we were all just talking about a few minutes ago, where the court also says, with regard to Ms. Rendell's, my understanding of what Mr. Dykeman said is that one of them at least... is at least that she worked for the tribe, not because she was one of the tribe, but she worked for the tribe. That's entirely different. That's the finding that the trial court made. The Court of Appeal
was wrong.
Could reasonably have.
No, but the Court of Appeal said if that were the only reason, we'd have concern.
Right.
But remember, the premise of my question is that we have some concern with the right way of saying it was racist. Okay, so this particular statement the Court of Appeal does not buy into. This is the reason the Court of Appeal, this is the reason offered by the prosecutor that the Court of Appeal says is no good. Now, my question was, putting aside this reason, we know the Court of Appeal disapproves, where is the finding that the other reasons offered by the prosecutor were the predominant reasons under the Court of Appeal's analysis?
Well, the Court of Appeal on page 19 of its opinion...
Well, no, it wouldn't be in the Court of Appeal opinion.
Yes.
It would be in the trial court opinion. But the Court of Appeal says the trial court could have found the other reasons predominant.
Could reasonably have found. Yes, and I interpret that as a statement of reasonableness.
The Court of Appeal doesn't make findings on its own. It's simply saying the Court of Appeal could have. So I'm asking you, where...
Well, it's the same thing I just read. It's at the very end of those arguments and the statement of the prosecutor where the court actually says the court finds there is sufficient justification. Yes.
About something. I can't tell whether parts of your colloquy with Judge Kaczynski result from what always happens, judges focus on particular lines of the record and then the lawyers find out about it in argument, or whether you're trying to get us to decide the case on a broader ground than we need to. Here is my concern in a nutshell. When I look at the record, it looks as though we just don't need anything like the breadth you suggest. For example, where the Court of Appeals says we would have some cause for concern, and leaving aside whether they're saying there this would be unconstitutional or whether they're saying what they mean, they have cause for concern. what they refer to is the previous sentence. That if the only reason was the assumption that Native Americans are anti-establishment, they're not talking there about working for the tribe at all. Then they go through a list of new reasons that are race neutral, and then they say these reasons are race neutral. And then the legal analysis they use is they say, if the prosecutor is correcting based on a perception of individual bias, that's constitutionally permissible. If the prosecutor is correcting based on an assumption of group bias by race, that's unconstitutional. And then they say at page 20, ER 63, line 7 and 8, that the reasons were based on individual predilections, as individual predilections of the jurors, supported by the record, not sham excuses, and not disguises for group bias. So it looks like we don't have to go anywhere near as far as you want us to go.
Well, I didn't mean to imply that I want you to go any further than that. I was attempting to answer Judge Kaczynski's questions about what that statement. He was asking me to assume, for the sake of argument, that that was, in fact, the case. And based on that assumption, on that request, that command, I was doing that. I didn't get very far, but I would agree with you completely that this is exactly the kind of finding that's sufficient to support here. We have to defer to this finding by the State Court of Appeals.
Can I ask a more...
Beg your pardon?
Which finding is
both findings. The Court of Appeal...
They are based on individual predilections supported by the record.
Exactly. Those findings there...
That's not a problem. Fine, I accept those.
Mm-hmm.
But the Court of Appeal also says there was an impermissible motive. So we have permissible motive, we have impermissible motive. Now I have to sort them out. And the Court of Appeal gives us a rule. It's not the rule that the federal courts have accepted, but it's a rule, and the rule is you look at the predominant motive. Right? And the next sentence they say is the state trial court could have found that the other motives were predominant. So we have good motives and bad motives. Good motives were accept, bad motives were reject. State court could have found that the good motives were predominant. So you're almost home. All you have to do is show me where the state trial court in fact found those other reasons to be the predominant. Show that and you're home free.
Well, I think...
So this is what we were when Judge Ponce was rejected. So do you have something that where the trial court says bad motives, bad, you accept those. Good motives, you accept those. Those are predominant.
No, I have just exactly what I read.
So we're finding that admitting the bad motive, admitting the bad motives we accept, the good motives are predominant. Which court made that decision and where?
It's an implied finding by the trial court based on the arguments and the discussion.
We didn't correctly view, according to the Court of Appeal, the trial court thought all the reasons were race neutral. And here the Court of Appeal, if you look at page ER62, they point out, this is for the defendant, without justification, that the underlying assumption that Native Americans as a group are anti-establishment is itself based on racial stereotype. You remember what I'm reading from?
Yes.
The other place.
Yes, that's page 19 of the opinion.
Says, when the trial court says that's a race neutral reason, the trial court was wrong. So how could a trial court that misreads a race bias reason as a race neutral reason make a determination that these other reasons, which also think are race neutral, are predominant? Where would we get a chance to do that?
Because the trial court listened to the district attorney talk about his reasons and found that the reasons that he gave that were race neutral, which were identified in the Court of Appeals opinion,
all of them were race neutral.
He thought.
Is there any doubt on that score?
The trial court made.
All of the reasons were race neutral. Why would it have a reason to single out some as being predominant and others as not being predominant? What reason under its own thinking would it have to do that?
The trial court made an attempt to separate the district attorney's statement that Native Americans who work for the tribe. The trial court interpreted that statement as meaning an employee of the tribe. If the prosecutor had said, in my experience in Humboldt County, employees of the tribe are resistive of the larger society's criminal justice system, we would have a very different case here.
Sir, could you please tell me, now, to cut off the specifics for the moment, what your position is with regard to whether there is a mixed mode of analysis, whether it requires a burden shifting or not? I understood at some point the state's position seemed to be that the burden is always on the plaintiff and that the usual burden shifting that goes on in equal protection cases generally is not applicable here. Is that your position or not?
No. Our position is the Title VII cases that were talked about in Batson itself and in the other cases that I've cited from the other circuits, which is that the proponent of this claim that there was an impermissible motive has to get to a certain point and show that there was a motivating factor present that was impermissible, and then the burden shifts to the prosecution to justify it, to rebut that. Our position is that was an implied finding by the trial court here after listening to.
But even the Court of Appeals talked about predominant motive. Do you understand that to be the same thing?
Yes.
A motivating factor, a substantial reason, and a predominant motive are all the same thing.
No. Motivating factor would be more analogous to the situation where you have a prima facie case issue, for example, in the first step of Batson, where you have to just show that there was a motivating factor here.
Is the word predominant motive used in any of the Supreme Court equal protection arguments or anything like it? I mean, isn't what they're looking for essentially a but-for cause, as your opponent was suggesting?
That's right. It is a but-for. They have to find that the prosecutor has the burden of showing that it but-for that
reason. Well, why is that predominant motive? You could have three reasons, any of which would have been but-for.
Well, when the trial court made its finding that there was a sufficient justification, it was made after listening to all of the reasons, the five reasons, four of which were race neutral.
I'm now looking at what the Court of Appeals said. It's using the term. I'm trying to find out whether the Court of Appeals' apparent assumption that predominant motive is the standard is consistent with the general equal protection cases that you agree applies.
I believe it is consistent.
Why is
I think that?
That
predominant means that this is the dominating reason. This is the reason that really motivated the prosecutor, not these other reasons are the reasons, not this one off-the-cuff remark that, in my experience, Native Americans who work for the tribe.
Because he then went on, and as I said before, and started trying to prove up his belief that Native Americans in general are in some respect anti-authority and so on. So it certainly developed. He went back to it and he expanded and he went into facts that weren't even the case.
You know, I reread that part of his comments over and over again, and you know, if you will recall, he was quoting or paraphrasing a defense expert who would come in regularly into these criminal trials involving Native Americans. For example, the Hoodie Croy case where a peace officer was killed. And he was summarizing this defense expert's theories to juries, to criminal juries, that according to this defense expert, it's okay. You know, you have to sort of give some leeway and some latitude when you have a Native American defendant, because child molestation is okay in Native American culture. I found it very interesting that the prosecutor brought up the child molestation question, because that was really the motivating issue here with regard to Deborah Rendell's, her daughter having been molested.
But really, quite aside from that, I really am having trouble understanding how predominant motive is the same as a but-for-cause. A but-for-cause concept is, as I understand it, you could have you could be a person who says, look, if you had somebody who was an Indian, a Native American, and a weak person, I would eliminate them. But if they were a white person and a weak person, I wouldn't eliminate them. But also if they were a Native American and not a weak person, I also wouldn't eliminate it. So essentially, both the Native American and the weak person were but-for causes. I wouldn't have eliminated this person except if both of those were the case. So which is the predominant motive?
Here, the predominant motive were the four reasons.
No, I'm not asking you. I'm asking you conceptually. How is that a predominant motive analysis? It's a but-for-cause analysis, but it's not a predominant motive analysis.
Well, I think that they're the same thing. I think predominant simply means that without that motive, you wouldn't have the action that we're talking about here, which is an exercise of a peremptory challenge.
It seems that there is one that is bigger than the others, and that is not a but-for-cause concept.
If the Court of Appeals had said the real reason for
doing this for these individual factors that had nothing to do with race.
Mm-hmm.
Would that have been okay?
That would have been fine, and I think that that's what the Court of Appeals said. And it's in this whole paragraph that was just read to us by Judge Kleinfeld in page 19 and 20, this whole section here, that's exactly what the Court of Appeal is saying here. And I think under the ADPA, we have to defer to that fact finding, even if it's by the Court of Appeal. They're doing two things. They're making a factual finding, and they're finding that it was reasonable for the trial court to make this implied finding of sufficient justification based on the litany of reasons that were given here.
Just to follow up on Judge Berzon's question, the Court of Appeals uses that phrase predominant motive there on page 20, and it puts it in quotes. And
right.
I can't find where it comes from.
I can't either. I did notice that it was in quotes.
We don't really know what the Court of Appeals had in mind there when it put it in quotes.
We don't know that. It's possible that it's in United States v. Bishop. I'm not sure. I have to reread Bishop and find out, because it does footnote that in rejecting the argument that the sole reason, as long as there's one race-based reason, that's good enough to reverse the judgment. And in fact, that's just the opposite of what Batson held twice in its opinion, which is that the Equal Protection Clause prohibits the exercise of a peremptory challenge solely based on race. See, that's a flip-flop. That's exactly the reverse position of what Batson itself held. The cases are legion that hold that that you are not held to this high standard if there is a single impermissible reason. And in fact, that's what the Title VII cases all talk about, that Batson itself discusses at two different places in the opinion, that you can have certain reasons that don't pass constitutional muster, but if you then find that the but-for or predominant reason is a good enough reason, then that's the end of it. And there is this process that you go through. And it's our position that this process was followed here, and it is certainly the process that was followed here is not inconsistent or an unreasonable application of United States Supreme Court precedent. And I see I have about 50 seconds left. If there are no more questions, I'll just sit down and have a drink of water. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. The Miller L case provided in footnote 6, I believe, that it is CJA analysis, comparative juror analysis, is appropriate for even for the first time on appeal, and that the voir dire record is.
Do we even have a record? Do we even have the transcripts in the record at this point?
Yes, Your Honor. It's my understanding that the transcripts are part of the record. The Miller L case also was quite clear.
Were they held in the district court?
Yes, they were, Your Honor. The Miller L case, stated that the question twice, and it said this twice, was whether race is a motivating factor, not whether race was the pure reason for the prosecutor's exercise of his strikes. With respect to Judge Reimer's question earlier, she asked, why does it matter whether we shift the burden? The U.S. v. Taylor case, which was decided by the Second Circuit, applying a mixed motive analysis, was very clear that once an impermissible motive has been established, that the prosecutor's burden to go ahead and justify the strike requires him to do more than he would if there were no impermissible motive. That is, he has to explain the manner in which the race-neutral characteristic.
I don't doubt that if that's known going in. The thrust of my question, though, is now on habeas review, where we're looking at it through a very different pair of lens. As I read what other circuits have done, they take the bottom line finding of no pretext, that is, no discrimination, and from that finding, they imply what's necessary for a mixed motive analysis. I mean, everybody else has done that.
I would respectfully disagree. I think most of the circuit courts that have found mixed motive to be reasonable have, in fact, required a showing that the state court followed the proper burden-shifting standard, with a couple of exceptions. But I think virtually all of the courts, certainly the Second Circuit, the Third Circuit, and the Fourth Circuit, have all done so. The Eighth and the Eleventh have occasionally allowed the two to meld. But
counsel, I don't understand
how it can be done if the defendants don't ask for it. Mixed motive analysis sounds like a very fancy conceptual thing. What it really means in practice is, how come you corrected the Indian who worked for the tribe, but not the white who worked for the tribe? How come you corrected the Indian who went to AA meetings, but not the white who went to AA meetings? That's what mixed motive analysis is.
But
if the question isn't asked during the voir dire, there's no occasion for the prosecutor to give an answer, and there's therefore no occasion for the trial judge to make a finding and a conclusion.